This is a CBC podcast.
Hi there, I'm David Cochran, and this is the Power and Politics podcast for Friday, April 19th. Provinces push back against the federal budget. We'll talk to New Brunswick Premier Blaine Higgs about Ottawa's spending plan and the resignation of a New Brunswick cabinet minister who says his beliefs no longer align with the PC party. Plus, international calls for de-escalation after an apparent Israeli strike against Iran. What does this latest attack tell us about where this broadening conflict could be heading? Canada's premiers are pushing back against the federal government's 2024 budget. They say Ottawa did a poor job of consulting them before tabling it. Nova Scotia Premier Tim Houston wrote a letter to the Prime Minister on behalf of all the premiers. In it, Houston writes, the federal government must refrain from overreaching into provincial and territorial jurisdiction, particularly in the areas of health, education, and housing. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said today that Ottawa will work with all orders of government to make life easier for Canadians.
I don't think Canadians are well served when orders of government are fighting with each other. I think it works best as a country when we're looking to collaborate. We're looking to work together in ambitious ways to create housing, to support universities, to support citizens.
For more on this provincial pushback to the federal budget, New Brunswick Premier Blaine Higgs joins me now. Premier, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, David. Nice to be here.
I've read the letter you've all signed. It's a forceful but polite letter, but you have very bluntly said this budget is absolutely shocking and totally out of control, which is even more blunt. What's so shocking about this plan from the federal government?
Well, it's a never-ending spending platform that we've seen now for the last 10 years. And, you know, the affordability in the country that was promised 10 years ago for homes being affordable, it hasn't changed. It's gotten worse, hasn't improved. But as concerning as the level of debt that the country's taken on, the level of exposure, we talk about a budget that was going to help people, in the 10 to 30-year-old or 20 and 30-year-old range. But what's the future outlook in a country that continues to grow its deficit and continues to grow its debt? I'm very concerned about the long-term view of our country, and we know productivity is an issue, but now financially we're putting our country at risk.
Well, the debt is high. There's no question about it, and the debt servicing costs are growing, but a lot of that debt was debt they took on during the pandemic because provinces couldn't necessarily shoulder that burden. Now they're trying to catch up with some of the problems created by COVID, and there's $52.9 billion in new spending there over the next 5 years, targeted a lot of things like housing. But you don't think they should be doing that, even though that's one of the big issues right now?
Well, certainly housing is a big issue, David, but there's only so many houses you can build with the capability we have in the provinces. So, you know, it's a great headline to say we're going to put more money in and put strings around it so provinces will have to abide by these rules. But, you know, we've got about 5,500 new starts in the province. And yes, if it should be, you know, we can use the money to go into the province, and that's a good thing. But we only have a certain capability of what we can actually build. And that's a nuance to it all. So is there anything here that's going to actually make it cheaper, more affordable for people to live in their country or in our province? And I would say no. And the policies on energy have driven up the cost of everyday living, which in turn have driven up the cost of everyday supplies. So it's kind of a hollow argument that is targeted on a certain audience. I would say for political reasons.
Well, there's money there for scaling up modular housing so you can be building, you know, components for homes in the winter season when it's tough to do the construction outside. This is something the Home Builders Association will say, more factory-based construction of components that over time will really boost productivity and scale and deal with some of the labor gaps that you're dealing with, especially the seasonal ones. I mean, there are efforts there that could pay off in a few years.
Well, we have, a $500 million housing program here in New Brunswick, and we have contracts with our modular home manufacturers, of which we have a number of them, six, seven of them in our province. And so we are going down the road and have been for some time. But so it becomes, again, what's the capability to do even more? I guess if I was, had a young family in that situation every day, I would look at how is it going to be cheaper for me to live every day in my community, to work and drive to work and to buy groceries. And I would say, what in this budget has helped that? Well, and I would say very little.
Right, but on the question of housing, I mean, if for the past year we've watched premiers, and federal opposition leaders say the federal government has done nothing on housing and needs to do more on housing. And now that it's doing things on housing, it's being criticized for jurisdiction and spending too much. I mean, what's the balance here, Premier, if this sudden urgent focus on this issue isn't the right approach here?
Well, the sudden urgent focus is, I would say, certainly one that is politically driven, but driven because of the concern about not having enough homes. But if you say, what can be done through this? So, yes, can we build more in each province? Can we? If we can, then more money can help in that regard. But what are the issues that are going to help us? So if you look at the number of homes we need versus the population growth every province has had. So how do the two match up, and where do we need to get controls on that situation so that we can actually manage the growth of our country and our provinces going forward and build what's required? You know, are there other issues that the federal government should be focused on, you know, in today's world? And I guess international trade conditions, our national security, there's a lot of things. And then the other aspect of economic growth. You know, the only project that they talked about with economic growth was the pipeline that they invested in and paid six times more than they should have for it. So where's the economic growth in our country that's going to compete with other countries? And what's going to drive our economy? And where are we going to have the jobs going forward to be competitive? I mean, there's so much more that a federal government needs to look at on a national basis. And housing is only one component.
Right, but Kevin Lee from the Canadian Home Builders Association, you know, they rolled out these housing announcements over a series of weeks, as I'm sure you're well aware. He said some of the changes for mortgage amortizations for new buyers could potentially unlock up to 34,000 new units being built right away, just because it creates that kind of demand, as long as they can get the approvals at the municipal level to do these things. The GST cut on apartment construction led to a boom in purpose-built apartment rentals last fall. I mean, this is economic activity. This is housing stock being increased by these policies. Is it all a failure in your view?
No, I guess my point would be, and so the GST change, I mean, we didn't all do that in the country. I met with developers in that process, and what new homes were going to be built based on the change in that regard. Were tenants going to see a cheaper rent at the end of the day? And I didn't get those commitments. And so then when you look at, no, they're not all failures. I'm not suggesting that. But I'm saying there is a capacity issue, and there is also an autonomy issue where we're saying, let us work with municipalities, which is the order of government, federal, provincial, and municipal. But the federal government has decided to go direct to the municipalities. And so at the end of the day, is there a joint commitment here that they're expecting from provinces, or is it going to be a competition? And we've worked well with municipalities in our own housing program, and we would like to continue to do that in a productive way and with the federal government in the process, and not try to short circuit the system.
Look, there's no question there's a capacity issue, and the labor supply is going to be the constraint, if there is one, on any ambitious plan to build housing at the scale the country needs by about 2030. But with the money they're bringing directly to municipalities, there's nothing I've seen in any of the language around the announcements that they're counting on provincial governments to match it. All they want from provincial governments, it seems, certainly on the infrastructure money that was put in this budget, the $6 billion, is zoning changes, you know, broadly across your jurisdictions. You know, you're a first minister facing an election this year. If you were being yelled at by people to put money into something, you'd want to put it in a way that gets the results that you need, wouldn't you? I mean, that's what they're trying to do here. The politics of it seems pretty clear.
Well, the politics seems clear, but the timing is not so clear. The details are not so clear. And how much impact it will have this year over what we're already doing, because every province is building, you know, essentially to capacity. So I think that, yes, it is. It sounds good. It looks like we're going to have a more houses delivered. But what is real clear, David, in terms of if all of a sudden we were paying 20 cents less a liter on fuel, that would be a clear differential. That would make a big difference in everyday lives, and subsequently roll into costs of other commodities being reduced. I guess what's going to have the greatest impact, and I know it's a challenge. We all face it, but everyone that is paying more every day for what they do is a huge affordability issue, and housing is one component. There are many other components, but we will work with the federal government as much as we can to work as fast as we can.
Yeah, I think the housing, they view it more as a generational fairness issue and an affordability issue kind of lumped together. But you mentioned the price of fuel. And I know you've all been pushing for the meeting with the prime minister to try to get him to change his carbon policy and his carbon tax. It went up by 3.3 cents a liter on April 1, and everybody wanted a meeting about that. Why were the premiers so silent when the oil companies raised the price of fuel this week by like 12 cents a liter in a lot of places? Because they were moving over to summer gas. I mean, this is something corporations are doing. That's 4 years of carbon tax overnight, and it's all driven by the industry.
Well, it's driven by the summer regulations and the vapor pressure requirements and restrictions on summer fuel. So that is not a new thing. It happens every spring and it changes every fall. So it costs more to refine product for summer regulations. And that's where it comes from. So it's not, you know, along with the market volatility that we've seen, you know, over the years, that is a seasonal thing that happens, and it's not a new thing. But I guess you look at, okay, what is part of it? Is there another opportunity to get cheaper fuel in some way? And maybe. But regulations on just for the sake of regulations, or addition on carbon, on a carbon tax, which you're saying, is this really doing anything but other than just costing more? And David, I've proposed an opportunity for us to really affect emissions in the world and really drive down emissions by shutting down coal plants and converting to natural gas and doing what other countries are doing. I mean, it's kind of ironic that China has 1,100 coal plants, building, let's say, one to two a week. And then we'll say, well, they're supplying cheap batteries to us, so they have cheap manufacturing. Well, of course they do. They have a climate conditions that aren't even considering world emissions. And here we are consuming products at record amounts. And in the meantime, driving affordability up in our own country and driving a situation where competitiveness is almost a far reach. It the whole philosophy is just not focused on the big picture. It's focused on the little bubble of, let's say, selective in individual provinces.
Okay. I do want to stick with on the environment, but I want to ask about your now former environment minister, because Gary Crossman announced today he's resigning from cabinet, and he put out a resignation letter saying, my personal and political beliefs no longer align in many ways with the direction of our party and our government. What happened that your minister quit today saying he no longer supports the direction you're taking your party?
Well, he actually announced last fall, I believe it was October, November, that he would not be reoffering this fall. So that was not any surprise, and it was well known and well publicized at the time. In fact, we already have a candidate that was nominated back in, I think, November.
He was going to stay on, though, right? I mean, he had committed to stay on, and suddenly he's not, right? He's leaving now, and not necessarily endorsing his successor because they're seen as a social conservative. Is that what's driving this, Premier?
Well, I mean, that could be his view, but I guess, David, if the position in our party is that we believe parents should have a role in raising their kids, is considered as a far right issue, you know, we got a real societal problem. And it has been a challenge and a discussion here in our province, there's no question. But I think we need to just pull back a little bit and think about what is the role of the foundational family in our country and in our province. And we've taken a position that parents are important. And we don't rule out all parents. And we say parents in general are very, very responsible for the kids. And they wanted to have that ownership. And they've learned that, wow, there are things happening that they didn't know about. And in the situations where that is a problem, then we deal with that in the one or two cases, whatever that amount might be. But it isn't a case of ruling out all parents. And if that is considered a real far-right issue, as I say, we need to really evaluate what has built our country strong, and it's been the solid foundation of families.
But is that what triggered this today? I mean, he announced in the fall, obviously, that he wasn't going to run again, and clearly his discomfort with what he calls a Christian conservative successor in his particular seat, that he may not vote for that person. But now to quit abruptly after committing to stay, and that final sentence saying, I stayed 6 months too long, is what he says, and this is all just going in a direction I can't support. So was there a trigger point? Did you have an interaction with the minister or a conversation with the minister that led to this, or did this come at you out of the blue?
No, it didn't come out of the blue, and there wasn't any particular trigger point, but I knew it was coming. But I think that you know, when we have the different views in the terms of the policy that I just mentioned, and in our case, the policy 713, it is kind of, that part's kind of shocking. But I think it goes deeper than that. You know, we have a candidate in the riding, and we've had new candidates coming into the party. And I think it's really exciting. I think we're seeing a revolution across the country with new people, younger people joining our party, getting involved. And we're seeing it all across the nation. And that's a good thing. That is exactly what we want to develop a future for our country. And you know, I know that comes tough for some, and it changes some of the dynamics within. But we need to embrace that. It's just like embracing new people coming into the country. Yeah? Our immigration, we're so, you know, dependent on immigrants to come and help us to regenerate our country and our province. And it's happening. And it's happening in our party. And, right. You know, we all need to move towards that.
Okay. Yeah, and just as a final question, Premier, because you've been on the show many times, and every second or third time there's something has been happening with your caucus, right? Like, you have people sitting on the outside quitting from cabinet. Now you've got this. It's up to about 10, I think. That have either left or said they're not going to run again, and you've got an election later this year. I mean, are you worried about the message all of this sends to New Brunswick voters with you facing re-election?
Well, we've had a combination of people that were planning to retire and people that did not support parental rights within our province and within our policy. And so the combination of those has led to a number of people that won't be reoffering. However, our position is clear on what we believe the role of parents would be and the role that they expect to have. And we know that's been a resounding, endorsement across the country in that regard. And it's no different here in New Brunswick. Right. So as we move forward to an election, we have new people coming in. We've had nominating commission. I have one in the morning that I'm going to. There was one last weekend. We're bringing new people into the party as well as other people that are joining our party. So I'm saying that, yes, it's a transition as people retire and as people decide that, okay, I liked it the way it was and I don't want to have these step changes. And that's okay because we all have our own views. But I am excited about the new people joining our party and driving us forward in a new generation in a progressive way that rebuilds our nation in a way that it needs to be focused. And families are a big part of that.
Premier Blaine Higgs, always appreciate the time. Thanks for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
The federal government has proposed $53 billion in new spending in this week's budget over the next 5 years, all to mixed reviews, I think it's fair to say, on Parliament Hill.
We are asking for the wealthiest in this country, the wealthiest 0.1%, to pay more in taxes so we can support the middle class.
For the first time in a generation, we're spending more on debt interest than on health care. That's money for bankers and bondholders rather than doctors.
This is a budget you will support.
So that's not a decision that we are making right now. While we fought for certain things in the budget that are very important, that are going to give relief to people, we have some serious concerns. And I want to hear from the Prime Minister what his plan is to address those concerns.
Okay, that's the drama of Budget Week. So what has the political fallout been from the Liberal government's proposed spending and targeted tax hikes? We're going to talk about that with the Friday Power Panel. Nigan Sinclair is a columnist for the Winnipeg Free Press. The CBC's Jason Markusoff joins us from Calgary. And here with me in studio, journalist and author Paul Wells and editorial writer for Le Devoir, Marie Vastel. Good to see you all, gang. Happy Friday. Paul, we knew a lot of what was in this budget beforehand. We didn't really have a clear sense of how high the debt servicing costs would be. And we sure didn't know about the capital gains tax, so there was a lot of conversation about tax increases. What's your overall assessment of the plan?
Well, I spoke to a senior advisor to the Prime Minister in the budget lockup, which is it's my annual talk with any senior Trudeau advisors. And they said they kind of like this fight. They like standing up for young Canadians against the rich and powerful. So there's two questions. First of all, have they guessed inaccurately about who constitutes the rich and powerful? Petition signed by 700 tech people. If you look up the tech people who signed that petition, they don't really look like Polyev conservatives or mustache-twirling bankers. They look like a very diverse and interesting crew. The second question is, Will the youth on whose behalf the government is fighting recognize that the government is fighting on their behalf and believe that the government is fighting effectively on their behalf? Mm. I don't know the answer.
I'm not sure anybody does right now. I mean, it's only, 72 hours or so, Marie, since this was tabled, and it's going to be many more hours before houses are built, before housing prices come down. Though some of the things will hit the system right away, like the mortgage changes that they're talked about. But where do you think they are? They were sort of laying out their message in the run-up to the budget on housing and things.
Yeah.
But since
that's
been the capital gains stuff, that has sort of like become a cacophony.
I mean, it has, but has it really in the broad population? I'm not sure. I think I agree with Paul. I think the government is quite happy to have this sort of debate about we want to be fair, their words. We want to have a fair tax system, a fair economy. And the other guys, the conservatives, want austerity. I think they're quite happy with that opposition that they're trying to draw. And I think the conservatives are quite happy to call the liberals pyromaniacs and arsonists and that they're spending too much. And I think we really saw this week, they were already drawn, but the lines really drawn as to what we're going to see going into the next election. I would say it's not a zero-risk game for the liberals because there was an Angus Reid poll saying that close to 60% of Canadians are worried that the liberals are spending too much. So I think the liberals are gambling that people won't care that much come the election, and blue liberals won't necessarily flock to the conservatives because they'll be a little weary of Pierre Poilievre. I don't think that's a zero-risk bet. On the capital gains, I don't know if the government fully thought it through because we're hearing, as you guys mentioned, you know, a lot of people saying you don't have to be that rich to have a plex that you were hoping to use as your retirement fund, like a triplex or a fourplex, you say in English?
No, fourplex is four units, triplex is three, duplex is two.
Yeah, right? So a plex. Yeah. And this doesn't apply only to the richest of the richest who make over $1.4 million a year. I don't think that number is quite accurate. But I think there's more people in the population who can't afford rent, who can't even find rent, than people who are worried about paying taxes on their plex or their second home. And so I don't think there will be a lot of sympathy. Yes, there's a lot of conversation about it. I just don't know that amongst regular, normal people, it's that big of a concern.
Well, Negan, this is what I wonder about, because pushback has been, and this is an argument that I saw advanced initially by Tom Mulcair, saying that people who've invested in property to pay for their retirement are going to be hurt by this. But when the argument in the country is the commodification of housing has made things unaffordable for people and taken things out of the market that they can buy for, and the increase in taxes is only on wealth you earn in a single year above $250,000 on a capital gains sale, or above an increased lifetime exemption of $1.25 million with another $250,000 at the old rate stacked on top. So you got to hit a lifetime sale of more than $1.5 million in profit before the new tax rate even kicks in. So where do you think this leaves this fight?
Well, I think it also means that, I mean, geographically, we have to realize that in areas of the country where people are struggling to find rent, in the big markets like Toronto, Vancouver, this is something that really may not be touching upon the vast majority of Canadians. But in areas of the country like the prairies, where homes are still affordable, and oftentimes the middle class, people who we are sort of emerging or higher middle class, I mean, many people in the prairies do own cottages, and seniors have a deep amount of investments based within condos and those duplexes that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And they've staked their chips in the middle on those sales of those particular cottages and homes. And then the other issue is the transfer of cottages from one family to another, and particularly amongst, let's say, a number of children. There's going to be some issues, especially if those cottages have appreciated in value to the point in which, like, who then will ultimately have to pay that financial, I'll call it a penalty, but that increase in value that's happening in the exponential increases in markets across those kinds of places. I mean, these are things that I think the Liberals may have miscalculated in terms of certain areas of their constituency. Now, of course, we realize that amongst the prairies, Liberals don't have a lot of support, but you did see one particular group quite dissatisfied with this budget, It was First Nations, and particularly the Assembly of First Nations, who were there right on the ground in Ottawa and were very concerned. National Chief Cindy Woodhouse talked about how this budget, while having $9 billion in support for First Nations, has really abandoned the major project, the legacy that the Liberals have had on reconciliation. The word reconciliation doesn't even appear in the budget, and that's a first for the Liberals.
Okay, no, it's in the budget. It's in the budget, Negan. It's just not in the budget speech. I want to make that clear. And there's also billions of previously announced funding that rolls out this fiscal year. I talked to the chief on the show earlier this week, so I just wanted to put that clarification out there. But go right ahead.
Yeah, in terms of the speech, but I mean, there was a lot of talk about the fact that reconciliation didn't appear in the speech itself. Anyways, the issue is that the $9 billion that's being attached to First Nations funding is pivoting away from some of the major pillars of what the Liberals have been focused upon for the past 9 years. And so what that says is that there's a kind of a shift in focus amongst the Liberals towards directing towards constituencies and really towards this affordability argument around youth in certain areas of the country.
So Jason, on that, I mean, they have been very explicitly clear that they were trying to reach Gen Z and millennial voters in the run-up to this. And I know there are people who have invested in investment properties or have secondary homes that the windfall sale from those will be lessened by this policy. I don't know if that's going to get a lot of sympathy from Gen Zs and millennials who can't get into an apartment, can't get into a first home, that your windfall is going to be slightly less or marginally less or significantly less than you expected it to be. But it seems like there is a class and generational component to the play here politically, if that's where they're trying to drive this.
Well, the language about the 1% of the 0.1% was it 0.13% that they're so eager to use? That's very squarely aimed at younger generations who see this generational wealth divide. It was interesting seeing former Finance Minister Bill Morneau come out against the capital gains tax, because I would imagine a lot of Liberals might in coming weeks or might want not to do not to have what happened to them when Bill Morneau was Finance Minister and had his business tax reforms, gradually and brutally savaged and assailed by business groups. And it wasn't like right away. It was all happened over several weeks, and they didn't really seem to have a response to that. And I remember being on this panel, like almost feeling bad for Bill Morneau, how brutal the messaging and the handling and the round criticism from so many groups was. They seem to have had come out with a defense of this, with this 0.1% thing. But you know, the tech innovation class has been certainly courted as donors and major supporters of this Liberal government and their agenda, although a lot of them will find a lot of flaws in what they're doing. But to have them as become a bit of an enemy of them, and banks being frustrated and the entire corporate class being frustrated by this, one of the first marked corporate tax increases in quite some time, could become troubling. And given that so much of the positive stuff was put out before the budget, this will, of course, could well be the long tail.
Right. Paul, you wanted to jump in there?
Yeah, I mean, it should be said that this capital gains tax treatment change has advocates who aren't, you know, affiliated with the government.
Yes, it's not
Trevor Tome, the economist, and Andrew Coyne, the official leader of the Economist Party. And it is striking that in the first 3 years of this government's mandate, it was desperate to increase tech investment. The Prime Minister showed up at something called the Doc Unconference in Muskoka with a lot of Canadian expats from Silicon Valley. He put Toby Lutke and Harley Finkelstein from Shopify on government advisory panels and things like that. And the idea was to get to make it so that tech companies could scale and invest and not sell out, but to continue to grow in Canada.
Yeah.
And now that class essentially unanimously says this treatment makes it very difficult for them to do it and very tempting for them to leave.
So just on that, Paul, the government pushes back on that and points to the entrepreneur tax credit that they brought in, which is aimed at the innovation sector and the tech sector. And essentially what it's done there is everybody who sells a small business qualifies for a lifetime capital gains exemption of up to $1.25 million. So your first $1.25 million in profit tax-free. Yeah. Then tech gets to take that up to $3.25 million at only a 33% inclusion rate. Then the profit up to $3.5 million is at the old rate of 50, and then anything above that is at the new rate of 66% inclusion. And if you've split that amongst partners, each individual can qualify for that. So their argument is that they've done things here, and broadly on the tax rate, they're still competitive with New York and California. I don't know what your sense is, the last sector buying it.
The last three budgets delivered by Chrystia Freeland, coincidentally, the three that were delivered while Michael Sabia was the Deputy Minister of Finance, each said that despite those measures, investment, business investment in Canada was not up to where it should be, was not competitive with the rest of the world, and that it needed to be encouraged.
Yeah.
Sabia's gone, so whatever.
Well, he's gone to Hydro-Québec, which may actually have deal with one of the investment tax credits that he put in place when he was – because, Marie, that seems to be sort of the industrial policy is driving things toward the investment tax credits to do the green transition. But on the political fight they're having over capital gains, whether individuals are affected by it at scale – they're not, but they work for the companies who are, because the new inclusion rate applies for all companies, whether they're big or small in corporations, like for professional services, like doctor's offices and lawyers. And it seems there is the risk they have of this becoming not about a capital gains tax, but a tax on doctors, a tax on retirement, a tax on tech, and a tax on jobs. Right.
I think there is that risk for sure. I don't think these people's criticism is unwarranted. I'm just not sure that there will be a lot of sympathy amongst the population for the reasons we've explained. But also, I'm not sure that any party, for now, seems up for picking up this fight for those people. There were no questions to the Prime Minister today, unless I missed one, on capital gains while he was in Victoria. There were few or no questions in the House of Commons about capital gains. I'm not saying they didn't talk about the budget, but about capital gains. I don't know if... Well, the NDP certainly won't go against it. I don't know that the Conservatives will necessarily want to take up that fight because of this sort of narrative, how the government has presented it, of taxing the rich and the wealthy. I don't know if any party is going to want to pick up the fight for, maybe they should, but for doctors, for small entrepreneurs, because of the optics of it and because it just doesn't fit their own narrative. So I don't know. I mean, time will tell. I don't know if this will just be something that festers for a few weeks or that actually settles in and that the government comes to regret it. I think we need a bit more than 72 hours to see.
All right, we got to say goodbye. I want to wish you all a good weekend. Jason Markusoff, Nigan Sinclair, Marie Vestel, and Paul Wells, thank you so much, gang. Always fun.
Thanks.
Turning to the latest from the Middle East, there are speculations that international pressure may be working as the world seeks to defuse tensions between Israel and Iran. An overnight attack on Iranian military facilities appear to be limited in scope. Israel has not claimed responsibility, but experts believe it was likely intended to send a message and not escalate the situation. The CBC's Chris Brown has more from Jerusalem.
The booms in the pre-dawn sky near the Iranian city of Isfahan signaled air defenses had identified an incoming attack. But it all appeared to be over quickly, and at Iran's high-value nuclear sites nearby, amateur video was posted soon after showing that everything appeared fine and secure. That messaging was repeated on state television, reporting that the intruders were shot down, no damage done.
Triggered by the presence of three small drones that were present in that area. Other than that, nothing has happened.
Israel has not commented on the attack, but if that was Israel's response, it represented a tiny fraction of the firepower Iran unleashed on Israel less than a week earlier. More than 300 projectiles were almost all shot down thanks to the combined efforts of Israel, the United States, Britain, and other countries. In Jerusalem, some said they were disappointed by the Israeli move.
I expected more, to be quite honest. I think more would have been even justified, considering they sent 300 rockets to kill so many people.
Maybe the tit-for-tat for now has ended.
This former Israeli military officer, who was once in charge of gathering intelligence on Iran, says the incident has left Israel facing an emboldened Iran and a tougher security environment.
Israel, we find it very hard to cope with the Iranian axis alone. And I think we need our partners. And in order to do so, Israel have to move in other directions, for example, regarding the Palestinian issue, in a way that it will ease the Gulf state, especially Saudi Arabia, to have normalization.
In all likelihood, Israel's focus will now swing back to Gaza, where its offensive has killed more than 34,000 and displaced 1.6 million people. Many there wonder if Israel quieted things with Iran so as to open a new phase of the war against Hamas in crowded Rafah. Will Israel come from the ocean, from the east or the west, or by planes? No one knows anything, said Abul Jabbar al-Arja. We have an indescribable fear. What are we waiting for?
The feeling tonight is that both Iran and Israel have taken significant steps back from escalation. But with both sides still locked in the same struggle for dominance, the fear is the pause could be temporary. Chris Brown, CBC News, Jerusalem.
So can concerns about a wider regional war be put to rest for now? Tomas Junot is an associate professor at the University of Ottawa's Graduate School of Public and International Affairs, and Dennis Horak served as Canadian ambassador to Saudi Arabia, head of mission in Iran, and director of the Middle East Division. Gentlemen, it's good to see you both. Dennis, if I could start with you, Israel's retaliation. Iranian officials have described it as a small number of explosions that caused no damage or casualties. Pretty small scale compared to what a lot of people thought could happen here and what we know Israel is capable of. What does this say to you?
Well, the thing is also the Iranians have claimed that they shot them down their air defenses. And so I think in a way they're taking the win. But in some ways, I mean, both countries have sent messages over the past week or so, or less than a week. For the Iranians, the message is that we have multiple sophisticated weapon systems and we're willing to use them. For the Israelis, they were able to demonstrate defensively that they're able to handle multiple systems and multiple rockets defensively. And offensively, the incident last night demonstrates that they have reached deep into Iran. Even only if it was only three drones, as the Iranians claim, they still got pretty far inside Iran. So the message to both of them, if they register, I think it's important that both countries, they have stepped back, but both countries have signaled they have a willingness and a capability to do some significant damage. And perhaps, just perhaps, that reaffirms their deterrent. Both sides, that we can sort of go back to where we were with the recognition that red lines have been crossed, but that both sides have realized that the other has capabilities and a willingness to use them, and perhaps that gives them some second thought, some sober second thought moving forward.
Tomas, how do you see it, and how do you think the pressure and the urging from the international community may have played a role in the size and scale of the different responses here?
Pressure by the international community or by some parts of the international community, so Western countries, the U.S. in particular, but also Arab states close to Israel like Saudi Arabia and Jordan, might have played a little role, maybe a bit more than little, but I think ultimately the calculus primarily came from Israel itself. An escalation that leads to all-out war is extremely damaging. Both sides have the capability to inflict significant damage on the other. I think ultimately in an open warfare scenario, Israel and the U.S. cause more damage to Iran, but Israel still suffers. So that deterrent on its own, which was partly reaffirmed by Iran with the large-scale attack on Saturday, is a significant constraint on Israel's action. So I think it's that balance of terror ultimately that restrains both sides. And that's why today we're seeing signals from both sides of de-escalating. Where I would say that things have changed is that we are not going back to the status quo from 1 week or 3 weeks ago, in the sense that, yes, we are probably seeing de-escalation now, assuming that Israel doesn't retaliate further, which is not out of the question. Mm-hmm. But things have changed, and the unwritten rules of the game between Iran and Israel have changed. Iran attacked Israel directly, which it didn't used to do, used to be indirect. Israel hit senior generals in a diplomatic facility in Syria. That was an unwritten rule that was violated. So the status quo has changed, and it is an unstable period because there were rules of the game before. We're not sure what the rules of the game are now.
So Tamad, just to stick with you, you said Israel could retaliate further. You said it's not out of the question. Iran could also retaliate. They are downplaying this on state television as sort of an insignificant thing. So what does that tell you? Do you think Iran could shoot back, or do you think they're going to try to settle it now?
Well, in practice, it's difficult to answer that question. Iran will not shoot back today or this weekend. I'm very confident that that's the case. Iran has wanted this to de-escalate for the whole week, and I think that's accurate. That's what they want. Israel, you know, one scenario that was under consideration in Israel since last Saturday's attack was large-scale retaliation, which would have led to probably escalation. Israel seems to have ruled that out for now. But nobody has ever said on the Israeli side that a smaller scale retaliation would be a one-shot deal. So we might very well be in a scenario now where Israel will continue to retaliate on a small scale. Always, ideally, and this is where it is dangerous, small enough that it doesn't trigger large-scale Iranian retaliation. That's where we were 3 weeks ago.
Right.
Both sides were consistently attacking each other indirectly in the gray area, hybrid warfare, and so on, without ever triggering a large-scale escalation. So it's basically where we're still at now.
Right. So, Dennis, do you see it that way, that it could go back to these smaller, more targeted, surgical, back-and-forth type things rather than that sort of massive Iranian assault we saw on Saturday, which had everybody, you know, white knuckling through the night waiting for the updates on it all?
Yeah, I think we will, because I think both sides realize that they came pretty close to the edge here and how things could have gone really badly with a couple of miscalculations or a couple of missed defensive weapons that landed in Israel. Things could have gone really badly. So I think both sides would be content to go back to where we were 3 or so weeks ago. The problem is, and as Thomas alluded to earlier, we don't know where that red line is anymore. If, for example, I mean, the Israelis, you know, they've assassinated nuclear scientists and various other generals in Syria and elsewhere, and Iran will not give up supporting Hezbollah or other proxy groups that target Israel. That will continue. But, for example, if Israel were to kill an IRGC general driving through Syria, not necessarily in a compound, a diplomatic compound, but is that the new red line? Does that mean that will then trigger an Iranian response?
Right.
We don't know that yet. What Israel did with the consulate was crossing a line, was doing something they hadn't done. They had done targeted assassinations before, and then that seemed to be within the rules of engagement. What are the new rules of engagement? I don't think anybody knows at this point, but I think both sides will continue to try and do what they've been doing for 4 decades.
Tamar, I wanted to ask you about an aspect of this I hadn't considered until we just played Chris Brown's report, and that's the notion that some people have in Gaza and other places that they calm things down with Iran because they're getting ready to do something with Rafah. And we know that Prime Minister Netanyahu has said they have picked a date for this. Where do you see the possibility of that? How does that fit into this dynamic here?
So, I mean, everybody stopped talking about Gaza for the last week, or a lot of people, I should say, stopped talking about Gaza, but it's not over. And on the Israeli side, the position remains fundamentally the same. Israel still wants to continue weakening Hamas. The objective officially is not really anymore to destroy Hamas or to eradicate it. I think everybody understands that that's unlikely. But Israel's objective of significantly weakening Hamas's military capacity and its ability to govern Gaza in the future, that remains Israel's objective, and that objective has not been achieved. So there is every reason to believe that Israel's attention will continue to focus on Gaza, obviously in the short term on Rafah, which is in the south part of the Gaza Strip, where probably a lot of Hamas battalions, troops, but also senior leaders are probably holed up. There are rumors, and this is just speculation, none of this has been confirmed, but that as part of American pressure on Israel to avoid large-scale retaliation against Iran, that in exchange for that, the U.S. would drop at least some of its objections to a large right. Israeli operation in Rafah. Is that the case? I don't know, but we'll probably see in the coming days and weeks.
You know, Dennis, there's been some analysis out there that the Iranian strike of a week ago, I think we talked about this in the aftermath of it, it sort of may have been a bit of a strategic error by Iran, is the argument that Israel was on its back foot facing a lot of international pressure over why things were happening and unfolding in Gaza. This then, people rallied to their collective defense and reminded everyone of how tenuous things are, and now they're in a situation where the focus was on the threat of Iran, and taken off necessarily the day-to-day of what's happening in Gaza, and here they are poised to potentially launch military action in Rafah. Where do you think the whole IDF campaign into Gaza rests now?
Well, I think, first of all, with the Iranians, the Iranian leadership is not known well for their lateral thinking. So I don't think that would have even been a consideration. The idea would have been strictly that these guys were hit within an embassy compound, and therefore we need to retaliate without even thinking what the broader implications would be for Gaza, for example. I don't think the Israelis are going to be deterred or moved in any way by the events of the past week to do what they're going to do in Rafah. They may have delayed it because of, as various reports have said, that the world's sympathy sort of switched and the world's attention switched more to Israel defending itself. I don't think Israel is going to be overly concerned about that. I don't think it's going to take priority of what they feel is necessary to do in Rafah or elsewhere in Gaza. So I think we've been talking about sort of going back to where we were 3 weeks ago. And I think in terms of Gaza, we'll be going back to where we were about 10 days ago or so, I think.
Okay. Tamar, just a final thought. Where do you think the Americans are on this right now? I know you referenced the idea that maybe, you know, if you don't escalate with Iran, maybe it helps you, you know, Israel accomplish your goals in Gaza. There's an aid package going to the floor of the House tomorrow for Israel, Ukraine, and others. Where do you think the American thought process is right now?
Well, the situation from the U.S.'s perspective has shifted a fair bit over the last couple of weeks. There were growing tensions between Israel and the U.S. on the possibility of an imminent operation in Rafah. It was not clear how that would be reconciled. That tension has really narrowed because the U.S. very undeniably and strongly came out in Israel's defense last Saturday. The U.S. played an active role in shooting down Iranian drones and sharing intelligence and so on. But now, as the prospect of renewed violence in the southern Gaza Strip comes back, that, you know, we can expect some of those tensions to resurface. Mm-hmm. There's also growing talk in the U.S. of what do we do after the war in Gaza? There have been more media reports recently of the U.S. trying to push Saudi-Israel normalization, which could come in exchange notably for progress towards a Palestinian state, whatever that exactly means. The U.S. pushing Israel to think about governance in Gaza after the war, which Israel has been very unwilling to do so far. So I expect these issues to start coming back up.
Yeah, the day after question, still not answered and rarely asked, it seems, in a lot of what's been happening over the last couple of months. I want to thank you both, gentlemen. Tamar Jeannot, Dennis Horak, always appreciate the time. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's it for today. If you like this episode, please follow the pod and catch our next live show on CBC News Network. We're on weekdays at 5 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm David Cochran. Thanks for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.